Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Litigation, Federalism and Separation of Powers, and Labor and Employment Law Practice Groups, was recorded on Monday, November 7, 2016, during a live Courthouse Steps telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federal Society's special Courthouse Steps teleforum discussing this morning's Supreme Court oral arguments in NLRB versus SW General Incorporated. My name is Nate Kaczmarek. I'm the Deputy Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. And today we welcome our expert, John Elwood, who is a partner at Vinson & Elkins LLP. Today I will turn it over to John to get us started. Following opening remarks, we will open the floor for questions. Thank you for speaking with us. John, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much. Let me begin by saying that I filed a brief in this case supporting the respondent, Southwest General, on behalf of the Chamber of Commerce, so everyone who's on the line should take what I say with a grain of salt. That said, I will try to keep my take as neutral as possible and keep the editorializing out of it and so you can draw your own conclusions. I came to Washington, D.C. straight out of a clerkship in 1994, and one of the episodes I best remember as a young attorney in D.C., as a young right-leaning Republican and committed Federalist during the Clinton administration, was the saga of Bill Lan Lee, President Bill Clinton's nominee to be Assistant Attorney General for the Justice Department's Civil Rights Division. Clinton had nominated Lee to be Assistant Attorney General, but the Senate refused to move his nomination because the Republicans who controlled the committee and the body considered him to be too radical. And yet he continued to serve in the position as an acting official for ages and ages, which Republicans viewed as an affront to the Senate's advice and consent function. Eventually, with Democrats remembering enough comparable episodes involving the Reagan and Bush 41 eras, Congress enacted a law to curtail the president's ability to have their chosen officials acting in those positions. People who do this stuff for a living call the resulting legislation the Vacancies Reform Act, or the Vacancies Reform Act of 1998. The D.C. Circuit added the unnecessary word federal out front, so for purposes of this case, a lot of people are referring to it as the FVRA, but as I say, people who deal with it every day view it as the Vacancies Reform Act. The statute and the challenge to its application that is at issue in this case are both quite intricate. There's a way in which this case is totally dry, and there is a way in which this case seems like the perfect D.C. insider case, and they are for essentially the same reasons. They involve very kind of insidery jargon that people who work in D.C. in these appointed positions know like the back of their hands, but which sound quite strange to people who don't do it. But this case revolves around three totally dull terms that if you're over 40 and use them in the D.C. steakhouse, the Palm, you'll sound like enough of an insider that someone will probably either buy you a drink or ask to be your intern. But if you use them in a podcast, people are at risk of falling asleep. So hopefully it will keep you awake. So this case involves positions in the federal government that require the individuals who hold them to be nominated by the president and then confirmed by the Senate, which is known as PAS positions. And that's insider term number one, PAS positions, for Senate-confirmed positions. Now, under subsection 3345A1 of the Vacancies Reform Act, which I will call A1, when one of those PAS positions becomes vacant, the duties and responsibilities associated with that position are normally performed by the person's top deputy, their number two person, who is known in technical terms under the VRA, Vacancies Reform Act, as their first assistant, who performs that role in an acting capacity. That's the term number two that you're going to hear a lot, first assistant. But the president can choose instead to designate someone else besides the first assistant to carry out those office's duties in an acting capacity. And there are two alternative choices: either someone who has been confirmed to another PAS position in the executive branch under subsection A2 of the Act, or someone who is serving in a senior official as a senior official in the very same government agency pursuant to subsection A3. Now, there is a pay scale for government employees, and one of the highest rungs is GS-15. It's the government service or GS scale, and GS-15 is pretty high up. And GS-15 is another way of referring to, you know, people who occupy that rung in the government agencies, and that is our third kind of insidery slash boring term, GS-15. So again, all of this case concerns filling these presidentially appointed Senate confirmed positions, and the three alternatives are the default, subsection A1, which is their first assistant, and then the two that the government, that the president can choose from, which is either another presidentially appointed Senate confirmed person, either in that agency or another agency, and which is A2, and then A3, which is somebody else at that agency who is a senior official, a GS-15, and those are the three opportunities. So cut to the facts of this case. In June 2010, the General Counsel of the National Labor Relations Board resigned, leaving a vacancy. President Barack Obama then instructed Leif Solomon, who was a senior career NLRB official who had been in another position in the agency for more than 10 years, to serve as the NLRB's acting general counsel. So the president went with the GS-15 option under A3. 7 months later, Obama nominated Solomon to serve as the NLRB's permanent general counsel. But the Senate failed to act on his nomination, which was eventually withdrawn. They were not big fans of him, apparently, on the committee. During this time, Leif Solomon made some very significant decisions, including issue an unfair labor practice complaint against Boeing for putting a new plant in South Carolina, which is a right-to-work state, and instead of in Washington State, which is a union shop state, allegedly in retaliation for past strikes there. So that was one of his many controversial decisions he took during that time. This dispute involves an NLRB proceeding that occurred in January of 2013 when Solomon was serving as acting general counsel. An administrative law judge concluded that Southwest General, which operates an ambulance service in Arizona, had committed an unfair labor practice, and the NLRB agreed. Southwest General then went to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit, where it argued that the complaint against it that Leif Solomon had issued was unlawful. They said that Solomon could not serve as the acting general counsel after he had been nominated to serve as the permanent general counsel. And they invoked another piece of the substructure of the Vacancies Reform Act. So far we have A1, A2, and A3. A1, of course, is for the first assistant, A2 for the PA, another PS position, and A3, the one under which Leif Solomon served, was for another GS-15. Now, under this position, B1, which is the heart of this case, it provides that notwithstanding subsection A1, a person who is nominated to fill a vacant position requiring Senate confirmation, quote, may not perform the office's functions and duties in an acting capacity unless the person served as first assistant to the vacant office for at least 90 days in the year preceding the vacancy, unquote. So, the way that the government had been reading that for years was that only applied to people who were serving as an acting official under the first assistant position, A1. And Southwest General said, no, that applies, that limitation applies to everyone serving as an acting officer. The federal government, as I say, said, no, that's only for the first assistants. And as it happens, the D.C. Circuit agreed with Southwest General. It said, you know, on its face, that applies broadly to anybody who is serving as an acting official, and they held for Southwest General. And one thing that's kind of noteworthy here is that it is a bipartisan panel. Even though a Republican appointee, Karen LaCraft Henderson, wrote the opinion, it was joined by Sri Srinivasan and Judge Wilkins, both of whom are Obama appointees. And Sri Srinivasan is formerly in the Solicitor General's office and a very well-regarded person. He was mentioned as a shortlister for the office for the nomination that eventually became Merrick Garland's to replace Justice Scalia. And I think that he will very likely be nominated to another such position down the road. And then a Ninth Circuit panel that was similarly heavily in Democratic appointees agreed. Judge Nguyen, I think, wrote that. I think she's an Obama appointee, joined by Judge Friedland, who's another Obama appointee, and a district judge sitting by designation, Cormac Carney. So the federal government then asked the Supreme Court to weigh in, which it agreed to do, even though the case is splitless. That is, every court of appeals has gone Southwest General's way. Now, I'll try to keep it as this discussion as short as possible so we can get to the discussion of what how argument went today, but I'll give you an overview of some of the arguments. In the Supreme Court, the federal government insists that its interpretation of this provision is most consistent with the text of the statute. Subsection A1, it explains, creates a general rule of the first assistant taking it, and A2 and A3 create other exceptions to that categorical rule. And B1, by saying that it notwithstanding A1, suggests that it only applies to the A1 limitation. And Southwest General instead focuses on the terms that come after that, saying, look, it applies to all persons under this section. And, it applies on its face to all persons, and it refers to this section. So it applies to not just first assistants, but everyone who is an acting official. And it says broadly, everyone under this section. It doesn't just apply to, the provision for first assistants. One thing that I think is very telling is the government relies an awful lot on practice. It notes that soon after the Vacancies Reform Act was enacted, the Office of Legal Counsel published an opinion giving its interpretation that adopted the view that it's espousing in the Supreme Court, and that the GAO, which is the congressional entity which is charged with overseeing the Vacancies Reform Act, agreed with it. And it noted that there have been literally about 100 officials, I think they said, or certainly at least scores and scores, that have been nominated to positions who their service would have been invalid under the challenger's reading of this statute. And yet no one in Congress raised a peep about that. And the federal government also notes that Senator Fred Thompson, who was the author of the relevant language and chief sponsor of the Vacancies Reform Act, said in a bit of, and I think in a floor statement, that the new provision B1, the limitation that is at issue here, applied to A1, the first assistant provision, quote, and specifically not to other officials pursuant to A2 and A3, referring to the PAS and GS-15 provisions. Southwest General says, that that's basically bunkum, pointing to another floor statement by Senator Byrd, who is another sponsor of the legislation, that is consistent with their provision. And, they throw cold water on the OLC guidance, saying that that was done essentially without analysis, and OLC doesn't have, Chevron, isn't entitled to Chevron deference. They also argue that it's very hard to, they try to say that it doesn't matter really that all of these people who were appointed consistent with the government's views, because these are very hard to figure out, essentially, and so you can't really put much emphasis on the fact that the Senate didn't object during that period. And I think that brings us pretty much up to where we are this morning when our argument was held in the Supreme Court at 10 o'clock. So it seems clear to me that most or all of the justices believe that the challengers have the better textual argument, that if there's going to be a reason for going against the textual argument, it's going to have to be because of essentially consistent practice in the executive branch. Right out of the gate, Judge Kagan, a Democratic appointee and an Obama appointee, began asking questions right out of the gate of the government's lawyer, which was acting Solicitor General Ian Gershengorn, making clear that she thought that the government's reading of the word notwithstanding in this provision B1, the limitation, would give it a meaning other than what you'd usually think. And she gave the government this hypothetical, which was kind of entertaining. You go into a restaurant and order 1, a salad, 2, a steak, and 3, a fruit cup. And then you say to the waiter, notwithstanding 3, I can't eat anything with strawberries. And she noted that under the government's reading, it would be just fine for the waiter to bring her a salad covered with strawberries because she only said notwithstanding 3. And she said that was, quote, a weird way of understanding the order, unquote. So significant that Justice Kagan, a Democratic appointee, is coming at this very skeptical of the government's position. Justice Alito then followed up on that, saying, that there's an important difference between subsection A1, the first assistant provision, on the one hand, and A2 and A3, the PAS and the GS-15 provisions on the other, because only A1 goes into force if nothing else happens. That is, that's kind of the default rule, and that is what is going to happen unless there's some reason not to do it. And he suggested that was the reason of the notwithstanding clause. You know, whereas under the other two provisions, they only say the president may do those things, and the president would presumably read that together with the restrictions on acting service and know, you know, basically he can't appoint anyone he can't appoint anyone who is a PAS official if they're also the nominee unless they served in the first assistant role for 90 days in the year preceding it, which is the relevant limitation. To follow up on Justice Kagan's restaurant hypothetical, Alito said it was like saying, you may bring me the soup of the day, but don't bring me a soup that contains shellfish. So Alito seemed to be clearly on the challenger's side here. Now, although Gershengorn did better than when he was arguing that there was this long tradition of accepting the government's reading, you know, the OLC and GAO opinions and the long history of appointing people along these lines, then Justice Ginsburg, again, another relatively liberal justice who you would expect to be relatively sympathetic to the Obama administration, she asked questions clearly, I think, adopting the challenger's criticisms pretty much across the board of all of these points. She noted that the OLC opinion was unreasoned, and that she noted limitations on the GAO's opinion that showed that she was really on top of the facts. And it's hard to tell how much headway he was making with Justice Ginsburg when he then was talking about how, you know, the significance of the fact that Congress didn't object and how you can try to infer from that the idea that Congress agreed with that reading. And then Chief Justice Roberts jumped in objecting to the idea of reading anything into the Senate silence, saying that it put a big burden on Congress to say that, you know, basically they have to speak up or they can be deemed to have agreed with the reading. And later on, Justice Kagan kind of gave credence to the Chief Justice's criticism, saying, I think, and this was in the Southwest General portion of the argument, you know, we don't usually read anything into Congress's inaction, basically, in response to these things. So it sounded like he was not getting a lot of traction on that. Then Gershengorn, Acting Solicitor General Gershengorn, mentioned the statement by the Senate sponsor Fred Thompson. And again, I thought it was significant how quickly Ginsburg leapt in there with criticism that were basically straight out of Southwest General's brief, saying, you know, noting that Senator Byrd gave a very different reading. And when Gershengorn tried to give his explanation about why you don't credit Senator Byrd, his floor statement there, because he wasn't really, he was just another sponsor. He wasn't essentially the person who was the chief sponsor of the legislation, as like Fred Thompson was. Justice Kennedy jumped in and, looking very seriously, said that even when the justices have consulted legislative history, they haven't looked at individual floor statements, which he said was, and these are my own quotes, the transcript came across only a few minutes before this teleform began, so I couldn't confirm some of them, but these were my notes. He said, legislative history at its weakest and most unpersuasive, unquote. And you don't want the Supreme Court's remaining swing justice to refer so disparagingly of your legislative history. Justice Kennedy was the first person to raise the practical implications of this, because one thing that is noteworthy is that the Vacancies Reform Act puts teeth in this provision, saying that basically for a relatively small subset of duties, that is, duties that are required to be performed by the applicable officer and only that officer. If a person does those actions and they act in violation of the Vacancies Reform Act, they're to have no force or effect. That's 5 U.S.C. 3348. But there are a number of carved out positions, so it's really only limited to the actions that only that official can do that are of no force and effect. And Kennedy asked what the practical implications were. And he said, and I think that this is very telling, and this is a direct quote because I went looking for it. He said, it seems to me our system is quite capable of accommodating respondents' argument, that Southwest General's argument. And on that point, Eight judges have looked at this, and every one of them has come to the conclusion that respondents reached, unquote. So Kennedy made two very important points there. He thought that there was really no parade of horribles that they could hold for respondents here and the government would lose, and it wouldn't really cause that many bad effects. And also he noted there that both the courts of appeals in D.C. and the Eighth Circuit and also the two district courts had all reached the same conclusion that respondents had reached. Gershengorn then raised, to try to, you know, bring up a parade of horribles, he raised the example of Linton Brooks, who was a person who served in a position, kind of a nuclear security position, where there was no first assistant, and essentially there would be nobody ready to act but for him. And Elena Kagan then jumped in by saying, asking whether the government would be subjected to uncertainty for acts that were basically how much uncertainty would there be if these acts were deemed not valid? One thing that struck me as significant there was, you know, after Gershengorn began speaking, Justice Ginsburg again jumped in essentially to sort of throw cold water on the government's assertion of a parade of horribles, saying that the challengers, you know, anybody else to take, that basically it's not just anybody who would be able to raise to invalidate various actions undertaken by acting officials over the course of the last 18 years. That they would have had to timely raise the issues, and the challenger in this case was one of the relatively few who raised the position all the way along, who had objected all the way along to the acting service of the official. Gershengorn responded by saying that even though they didn't like to, you know, disparage defenses that they might have to rely on later on, he noted that people who had served in this acting capacity had done all sorts of important things, like, identifying terrorist finance people and designating terrorist financiers to freeze up their financial accounts, and that others had issued regulations and taken, you know, litigation decisions that were all very important. I think that Gershengorn got the most traction in his argument when he talked about the purposes of the legislation and how it made sense when applied only to first assistance. This brings us back to the fact that this was heavily precipitated by the Bill Landlee episode, and he noted that he was a, you know, an acting official who was out of the first assistant position. And he also noted, without contradiction and without, you know, serious dispute from the justices, that nominees in PAS positions had served in acting officials even when they were nominated since 1868, and that he said, without objection, that you would expect Congress to speak more clearly before eliminating something that had such a long historical pedigree, which is one statement he made without real pushback. That was a place where he spoke for a long time without interruption. Elena Kagan also made the point that the first draft of the legislation that became the Vacancies Reform Act was quite clear in limiting the provision to first assistants, and then after it was revised to the current language, it was, quote, not so obvious at all, unquote, which is, you know, I think that hurts the government a lot when, she indicates one of the people, the votes that they would really be expecting to get is so clearly skeptical of their textual argument. That was pretty much the sum and substance of Gershengorn's opening argument. One thing that I thought was noteworthy was that neither Justices Sotomayor nor Breyer asked any questions of the government, indicating that they're probably the strongest votes for the government. But there was otherwise fairly strong skepticism across the board throughout. Then Shai Dvoretsky of Jones Day got up. He represents Southwest General. Justice Kennedy was one of the first people to ask a question of him. Dvoretsky got up and noted the argument that the subsection at issue here, B1, the limitation on acting officials, applied to persons, not first assistants, and it refers to, you know, the limitations, or it applies in this section. It doesn't just apply to subsection A1 or the first assistant provision. And Kennedy said, you know, both of those are very strong arguments. So again, swing justice, a guy who dissents about seven times a year, refers to their textual arguments as very strong. And he asked a question about what if the notwithstanding clause, a counterfactual argument. He said, what if the notwithstanding clause included both A1 and A2? And Shai Dvoretsky, you know, noted that basically that would be a very big counterfactual because, you know, of what I explained before already, that the thing that mattered the most was the distinction between A1 on the one hand and A2 and A3. And this is the point that Justice Alito raised, basically, that A1 was the only thing that applied automatically, so it made sense for notwithstanding to apply only to it. And that was essentially the answer that that Shai Dvoretsky raised. She, at that point, Justice Kagan expressed some skepticism about the challenger's reading, emphasizing the fact that the fact that A1 alone was self-executing, and this was really the only skepticism that the respondent's position got on the textual issue. She argued that A2 and A3 are just as broad and sweeping, and so it seems like they should also be included in this notwithstanding clause in this limitation, the B1 limitation, saying that basically notwithstanding A1, the first assistant provision, you know, anybody who serves as a nominee has to have served for 90 days at least in this first assistant position. And she said, you know, both the PAS and GS-15 provisions are just as broad and sweeping, and so it would seem like they should have also been included in the notwithstanding clause. And she said that the challenger's interpretation would require, quote-unquote, a strange drafter. Shai Dvoretsky gave an answer that I thought appeared to satisfy her. It's hard to say. She didn't ask any follow-up questions, and, you know, she didn't seem, you know, skeptical. She and Kagan was somebody who would ask very skeptical and pointed follow-up questions if she wasn't getting answers that she liked. And Dvoretsky essentially gave the position, imagine this very same statute if that notwithstanding A1 provision weren't in it. And he made the argument that I thought was a pretty strong one, saying that you know, the only position that would create a conflict would be that first position, A1, because there you'd get a command to install the first assistant as the acting official, and then you come along here and say that person can't validly act because they hadn't been in that position for 90 days at least, whereas the other positions, you know, saying the president may appoint a PAS person or may appoint a GS-15 in the agency, there wouldn't be any conflict there because they say you may do that, but there are also these other limitations on that. So, again, he seemed to take care of Justice Kagan's textual concerns. At that point, Justice Sotomayor asked a question about another provision, which is subsection C1. And I apologize, there's a lot of substructure. As I said at the outset, there's a lot of – it's an intricate statute and it's an intricate challenge. Now, C1 is a provision that allows people – who have already been Senate confirmed, but to a position that has a time limit on their service, like a 4 or 5 year term, to continue to serve in a holdover capacity even after that time runs out. And Dvoretsky noted that those aren't really deemed vacancies, that the legislative history of the act doesn't really refer to those types of positions as vacancies. It's really something else altogether. At that point, Justice Breyer, who, again, neither Sotomayor or Breyer asked any questions of the government, started asking questions, and he began his remarks by alluding to Kagan's restaurant example, and this was one of the bigger laughs of the day, saying that, quote, for every chef's salad, there is a countervailing strawberry shortcake, unquote, which is the kind of weird comment that Justice Breyer is famous for, but that get deserved laughs. I think he knew that it was a funny, it was a good joke, and it got the laughs it deserved. Breyer noted that the Vacancies Reform Act was motivated by the Bill Lanley episode, but he thought there was nothing about the challengers reading the statute that made sense with the Bill Lanley episode. Nobody was bent out of shape about, you know, GS-15s or PAS people serving in acting capacities. It was really only Bill Lanley, that first assistant, that made people so mad. And I thought this was one of the most important answers Dvoretsky gave because it kind of tried to make sense of it. And his response was that the first assistant, requiring people to have served as first assistants for a long period, which is his reading of this B1 limitation, is particularly suited for continuity in office. And he made the argument that basically when you're having these people serving as acting officials, even as their nominees, you want them to represent the least amount of change. And the way that you do that is by making them essentially have been a first assistant. And that way you don't have other people coming in, other PS officials, other GS-15s, and bringing essentially new ideas to the office, new leadership. And he said that essentially making people have been first assistants, which is what happens under their reading of this B-1 limitation, means it's the most continuity. It's the least likely to represent an end run around the Senate's advice and consent role. So I thought that was a pretty important answer, and he didn't get a lot of pushback on that question. Ginsburg then brought up this question again about what actions by these acting officials would be invalidated if the challenger's reading was correct. Again, as I say, there have been 18 years of officials acting under the government's reading that would be invalid if the challengers are correct. And Dvoretsky said, you know, not they wouldn't necessarily invalidate their challenges, they would have some defenses. At this point, Justice Kagan chimed in, and she was, I think, the person who was asking the most on the one hand, on the other hand, questions throughout this. But she said the government's history is so strong that she said if anyone in the Senate had thought there would be any real difficulty, if there was anything wrong with their reading, they would have piped up and said something. Dvoretsky responded that it's hard to identify those positions. That is, it's hard to know, to look at this nomination and look at the person's acting service and see if it's improper. It's a very intricate statute. And then secondly, the only action the Senate could really do with it was not confirm them. That is, if they thought that they were acting officials invalidly, about their only option then would be to not confirm those officials, and that's kind of a peculiar thing. Just because they aren't serving in an acting capacity is invalid, that doesn't necessarily mean you wouldn't then confirm them, which after all would just keep the office open longer. And then third, he made the empirical point that ordinarily they objected to nominees more on the merits, that is, the person wasn't qualified or they were too radical or too left-leaning or whatever, rather than objecting on the basis of a fairly, you know, intricate statute that not that many people understand. And Kagan said it would make total sense to say that they were also serving invalidly. It would give it extra oomph. And Dvoretsky responded to laughter that it really wouldn't to the person, and that it wouldn't make a lot of sense to object on those grounds to the person who has to explain the technical violation, because it is, after all, a very technical statute. In rebuttal, Ian Gershengorn, so that was the end of Shai Dvoretsky's argument. Then Ian Gershengorn got up. He was not really asked really any questions that I can think of in his rebuttal. He mostly kind of drew out points, kind of emphasized points that were made by Kagan, by Breyer, and by Sotomayor. And he basically just followed up with each of them on one point. Let me see here. Oh, I have a couple of mop-up things. Sotomayor asked questions, which I don't think were all that effective. They were more kind of griping about stuff rather than really making points about the respondent's position, saying, you know, basically that if the challengers, you know, when at a time when Dvoretsky was trying to say that the challengers, you know, that the government hadn't really made much of a point that a vote for the challengers would invalidate a lot of government positions, she then, you know, predicted that they would just be back in court to challenge those actions taken by the other officials, and, you know, noting that the Senate acted very slowly on nominations, and made a few other kind of general comments, but they didn't seem to be things that were really holding things up. Also, Dvoretsky, and this was, I think, another thing that he did fairly effectively, was that he noted that for all of these officials who were acting or who had acted over the course of the last 18 years while they were nominees who would not satisfy the challenger's interpretation of the statute. He noted a couple of positions that showing, I think, pretty carefully small subset of actions that can only be done by an official in that office that would be invalidated. And he noted a couple of positions where the government has already taken the position that that people who had acted in violation of the Vacancies Reform Act really didn't have any responsibilities like that, that the actions that they did were things that could have been done by other people at the agency, and those aren't the kind of actions that would be invalidated under the Vacancies Reform Act. So that is the full extent of my summary of the argument. That my two takeaways were thus. First, I thought that this showed kind of the court at its best. They were trying to do the right thing without regard to whom it benefits. You know, you had a lot of Democratic Democratic appointees who were nevertheless asking very hard questions, either of at least the government's lawyer, or which was the case of Justice Ginsburg, or of lawyers for both sides, such as Justice Kagan, who I thought was very dogged and really following the text of the statute wherever it took her. If I had to, and my second takeaway is that if I had to make a prediction, I'd say it's more likely that the challengers would prevail. Basically, it seemed like everyone seemed to agree that the challengers had the better reading of the text. Make the court feel like they could go ahead and vote with the challengers. And the fact that Justice Kennedy was of the view that the sky really wouldn't fall if they voted for them made it a safe vote. So with that, if there are any questions, I would be happy to answer them, realizing that, as I say, this is a very, very intricate challenge, a very intricate statute, and so it's not the easiest thing to ask questions about.
Okay, very good, John. Thank you for attending arguments this morning and for that great overview. Let me open up the floor now for questions from the audience. In a moment, you will hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, please enter star, then the pound sign on your telephone. One quick programming note before we go to questions is that our next Teleform conference call is scheduled for tomorrow, Tuesday, November 8th. At 1 p.m. On that call, we will discuss broadband privacy, the FCC versus the FTC. That call will feature Dallas Harris, who's a policy fellow at Public Knowledge, Michelle Rosenthal, senior corporate counsel for T-Mobile, and the call will be moderated by Neil Chisholm, the attorney advisor to Commissioner Maureen Olhausen from the FTC. You know, John, I was going to ask a question, but it looks like we have a question from the audience. Let's go to that question now.
Thank you. How do you think this case may affect the CFPB's appointment case that is also going to be coming up?
Huh, that's interesting. Let me see here. I'm looking over. So if you look at page 88A of the government's brief, which is available on SCOTUS blog, they have a list of there are certain statutory exemptions to this no force in effect provision, and the CFPB is not among them, I don't believe here. No, they exempt the general counsel of the NLRB, so automatically this case doesn't implicate that no force or effect. The Federal Labor Relations Authority, any inspector general, and any chief financial officer, but there's no mention of the CFPB. So I believe that this is a challenge to, and maybe you can tell me, caller, is this a challenge to the agency head of the CFPB?
Yes.
Yeah, because that's one thing is that one thing, the government generally takes a this is something that I handled. I was in the Office of Legal Counsel, and I can say as kind of a matter of practice that the government generally tries to say that there are, there's very few tasks that only one person in an agency can perform, that they generally like to say that there's like a broad soup of agency authority that could be performed by, you know, a large number of officials in an agency. I think that that's a harder position to make or a harder position to take with respect to an agency head. And I think you have to go through and see whether in the legislation that created the agency, whether there are any actions that only the agency head can do. Because if there's anything denominated by the statute as saying that, and I think that that's one of those kind of positions that there's relatively likely to have those things because it was such a controversial piece of legislation, I think it's more likely they would say only the agency head could do certain things. If there's anything like that that identifies him as being the official who has to do those things, they would have no force and effect. And the same legislation or the same part of the Vacancies Reform Act says that they may not be ratified. And so I would think that that would be relatively consequential. So it'll be interesting to see. That said, you know, I thought it was telling that that was not one of the examples that Ian Gershengorn raised. But there are two reasons why he might not have raised it. One is not to call attention to it and not to suggest that they're worried about it, because it's a very difficult position he was in this morning when the Supreme Court was saying, you know, tell us how the sky will fall. And he was kind of constrained in saying that because he doesn't want to admit that the sky will fall, because then if they lose, they will, all the challengers will say, see, he said the sky was going to fall. On the other hand, it may just be because the sky won't fall that he knows perfectly well that there aren't that many things that you know, only the agency head or any particular people can perform. So I don't know if that answers the question, but it does seem to me that, you know, uniquely out of many, many positions in government, that seems to me a position that is likely to take actions that might be at issue under the Vacancies Reform Act.
Thank you.
Okay, John, we have one caller waiting. Again, if you would like to enter the queue to answer a question, please enter star, then the pound sign on your telephone. Let's go to the next question.
I noted that Southwest General argued that the question wasn't sufficiently important to warrant the court's review. And it sounds to me like from the oral argument, there are a number of justices who seem to be agreeing with that position. Do you think that the fact that they granted cert tipped their hand as to the position they were going to take regarding reversal? Or how do you, you know, how do you interpret that? How do you interpret the fact that they seem to be saying the sky is not going to fall if we don't reverse this decision?
It's interesting, you know. Ordinarily, when you know, for all cases, the Supreme Court reverses, and between 2/3 and 75% of the time it grants, because, you know, ordinarily it doesn't take a case unless it strikes it as a little bit screwed up, and in this case it was splitless too. So ordinarily you would think, you know, they would have only taken that if they thought there was a pretty good chance that the court below had gotten it wrong. And that's one of the things that kind of surprised me about this, is I would have thought that there would be, you know, more of a sense that the government's position was correct, because, you know, basically the only reason to take the case is if you thought there was a pretty good chance that the lower court got it wrong. And in this case, I guess they must have thought, they must have concluded they'd either changed their mind along the way, or they just thought that they owed it to the federal government, you know, is this in the executive branch, the equal branch of government, that even though the lower courts had all agreed on its application, that they at least, you know, owed the government its day in the Supreme Court to resolve it. My own guess is that they probably thought, they probably changed their mind, because, you know, the government made a very good case at the cert stage that there was something kind of screwed up about this, and noting their long practice, I think, was enough to at least kind of give it the kind of facial patina that there was something very wrong here. And, you know, after full briefing, I think that the respondents were able to develop their strong textual argument, and I think it became clear through just study of the statute that that it probably wouldn't result in too much breaking too much china with respect to all of the other acting officials who have acted under a position that the government may. May turn out to be invalid. And I think that is one of the other kind of most noteworthy things about this case, that even though this is, you know, a relatively narrow objection, this doesn't kind of have the breadth of the sex appeal of the vacancies report, the Reese's appointment case, Noel Canning, that they did a couple years back. But one thing that is very interesting here is that if the respondents win, it means that literally for 18 years, the executive branch has been misapplying the statute, which I think is, kind of the biggest takeaway of this case, is that, even without a significant amount of objection, they've been doing it wrong for nearly 18 years, involving some of the most important officials in government, including the deputy administrator of EPA and at least three deputy attorneys general, including James Comey, who has been so much in the news recently, Paul McNulty, the second Bush 43, or one of the other second-term Bush 43 deputy attorney generals, and Sally Yates, the current deputy attorney general. So some very significant officials have served under a position that may turn out to have been invalid.
So this cuts both ways politically.
Yeah, it's definitely presidents of both parties have taken advantage of this reading, and it was a Democratic administration that first promulgated that view, and that it was under President Bill Clinton. But certainly, the Bush administration made ample use of that reading of the Vacancies Reform Act.
Thank you.
Okay, it looks like our phone lines are wide open. A reminder, if you would like to ask a question, please enter star, then pound on your telephone keypad. I do have a reminder to keep an eye out for emails announcing upcoming telephone calls. You can also consult the full schedule of our upcoming calls on the Federal Society's website, fedsoc.org. Also, there are podcasts of previously recorded telephone calls you may have missed there. John, it looks like we don't have any more questions. Would you like to maybe offer some closing remarks?
Well, I think my closing remark will just be to reiterate what it is I just said, that I think the most telling thing about this is that if the challengers wind up winning, and I think that they are probably, based on my read, they are favored to. The most significant takeaway here is that it kind of is a impugning longstanding practice of both Democratic and Republican administrations, which should both be kind of a sobering thing to people within the government to not be quite so sure of their opinions, and also a reminder to those of us outside of the government to be on the lookout for executive overreach. So.
Okay, very good, John. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank you for your time and expertise today. We really appreciate you joining us. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.